श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय। श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय। श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद की जय। श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। ग्रंथराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जय। श्री ब्रह्म स्तुति की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद। सो welcome to all of you. Good afternoon, pranam. Thanks so much for coming, and thanks so much to Krishna Chaitanya, Gopalandini, whole extended family for receiving us here. Shri Govinda Ki Jai. So, as you may know, we are continuing with a series of lectures on Sri Brahma Stuti, which have begun 10 weeks ago at Indranuja place and Lalita Sakis in Kansas, so that may continue maybe till next time I'm coming here next year or something, because it's a long series, 40 verses, so we are spending each one class per verse. Today we are in our 10th meeting. We had 2 introduction meetings, so today we will be studying verse number 8, which is arguably the most well-known verse of the whole Brahma Stuti. But before that, as usual, let's go to some brief recap and maybe brief introduction for those of you who are assisting for the first time to this series. The brief context is about regarding the Brahma Vimohan Lila. The background of the Brahma Stuti, or the prayers of Brahma, is the bewilderment of Brahma, as we know. And many times happens like that. When we are bewildered, we end up praying. and sometimes we pray, and the result of the prayer is further bewilderment. But hopefully in an upgraded version. So something like that's happening to Brahma. Brahma saw Krishna at the beginning of creation, and he prayed to him, "May I be your friend? May I have a relationship with you as a friend?" So he prayed for that. The result of his prayer eventually played out in the form of Krishna being in picnic with his friends and Brahma being bewildered by the result of his prayer at the beginning of creation. So there came Brahma Vimohan Lila. I won't tell the details of that section. And being totally bewildered, Brahma eventually starts to pray again. Now realizing who is the real object, of his prayers, because he thought he knew Krishna, as we say yesterday, and he knew Krishna on some level, and he will say that eventually in one of the prayers. Basically, that will be his concluding prayer. He will say, "Those who say I know Krishna, I pay my pranam from the other side of the street to them," something like that. Like he himself is thinking about himself. No, he's saying, "I met you in the beginning of creation, so I thought, and I'm the first guy meeting you in the whole creative cycle, so probably I know you. But now I'm realizing I cannot know you. The more I say I know you, the less I know you. No? And the more I say I don't know you, the more I know you." Something like that. No? Krishna's saying, those who say they are my devotees, they are not my devotees. Those who say they have love for me, they do not have love for me. Of course, it's not just saying that. Oh, so then I don't have love for Krishna. And I have love for Krishna. It's not like this. But Brahma is having this insight. Again, he's a pretty smart personality, topmost scientist in the whole creation, forehead thinking north, south, east, west. But now his foreheads are spinning by seeing Krishna's display of majesty expanding in the cows and the friends, and those friends then showing these unlimited Narayan forms and Brahma-like. And suddenly all of them wrapping up and just Krishna again remaining with a morsel of food and like, "Where are my friends and calves? And it's raining now, where they must be." And Brahma is like, "What's happening here? What's going on here?" So gradually he's realizing, "No, I made a big mistake. I committed deep aparad towards Krishna, towards his friends, towards his calves." And the result of my aparad is that the object of my love is standing in front of me, giving me such mercy. So, further bewilderment, in one sense. Upgraded bewilderment. Now Brahma is understanding who actually Krishna is, what's the mistake he made, but at the same time he cannot make sense of this is not proportional. No? I mean, I committed such an apparat, and Krishna is giving me his darshan. He's giving me by giving me his darshan, he's inviting me to relate with him as I asked him at the beginning of creation. May I be your friend? He gave me this trailer of Sakya Rasa, him being with the gopas in picnic, and I committed gross apparat. Still, he's there hearing my prayers. So, costless grace. What's costless grace? What's the price for costless grace? Today he will speak about that. Probably that's why this is the most well-known verse. It's pretty much connected to, if we are after mercy, what's the price we are to pay? Costless grace doesn't mean priceless grace. Be careful with mistaking the two ideas. Costless mercy doesn't mean you don't have to pay anything. Actually, we will see you have to pay a lot. And still it's costless grace. It's coming from above. It's not beyond in your reach, but you have to do something. But first, let's go to the recap of yesterday's verse, which was verse number 7, where we spoke about how everything is measurable except for Krishna. So I'll read the verse quickly, some words, and then we go to today's verse. So Brahma is saying, even for those highly qualified people who, given the time, might be able to count all the atoms of the earth, the snowflakes in the sky, or the rays of the sun, who amongst them could possibly count the qualities of you, who are the embodiment of all qualities and have descended to this earth for the welfare of all? So this is yesterday's verse. So Brahma is basically saying that. Now, even if at some point the topmost scientist in the world, which actually is Brahma, could count all this stuff, imagine like the drain drops that are falling now and the snowflakes in the sky and the rays of light. Even if that were to happen, which doesn't seem too possible, even that person will, nobody could count your qualities. You are gunatmana. You are unlimited, basically. There are different verses in the Bhagavatam with this same idea. And of course, there is a rhetorical question when he's saying, who could count your qualities? And of course, the answer is nobody. I'm having direct experience of that. I thought I was a pretty smart guy, but I cannot figure out who are you, basically. He refers to Krishna as gunatmana. Gunatmana, guna means quality, atma means atma. So he basically means many things, but the main of them are, you are the atma of all qualities, you are the soul of every quality, or your qualities are your soul. In other words, you are non-different from your qualities. Your atma, Krishna, is non-different from your guna. Krishna is absolute. So his self is non-different from his qualities, his name, his form, his lila. So Brahma is realizing all this now. Remember, each of these verses is one epiphany after another that Brahma is having. Like 5 minutes ago, I tried to kidnap your friends and cops, and I thought you were an imposter, ordinary guy having a picnic. And now I'm realizing Krishna is two Bhagavan. So yeah, my gosh. And the implications of that. What it means Krishna is the Supreme Personality of God. Your form is absolute. Your qualities are none different from you. And all this. So again, Brahma's forehead still spinning, but now for a different reason. Not for a higher, upgraded reason here. So, you are eternal, and your qualities are eternal, and ever-expanding at the same time. You are nirguna in the sense that there's nothing material in you, but you possess form, you possess qualities. We spoke about also how difficult it may be for some to understand this. The unlimited, absolute, unending, endless with form. And the form is unlimited. It's not a limiting form, but it's ever-expanding. But at the same time, it doesn't seem to be expanding. Like when Yashoda is trying to tie Krishna, and it's never enough rope. But Krishna is not expanding. He remains always the same size. But the rope keeps expanding. But it's never enough. But Krishna remains middle size. You follow the point. So Brahma is realizing these things here live. And here it's given this example from more subtle to more gross to subtle, from the earth if you count the atoms on the earth, if you count the snowflakes in the sky, if you count the light rays in heavens, even if you can do that, which is pretty extraordinary, for sure nobody can enumerate your qualities. It's not possible. And Brahma here is like fiberglass, that was his. And again, Krishna is just standing still with a morsel of food, like not saying anything, just like looking like naively, mukdata. And Brahma is understanding, okay, who is my Ishtadev? Still, the prayers are pretty much affected by Aishwarya, but eventually they will give place more and more to the intimacy that Brahma wants to attain with Krishna. But the proper foundation from that madhurya or intimacy, sweet intimacy, is proper understanding who Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan. So someday you can forget that and see him in terms of Sakya, Madhurya, Vatsalya, and so on. So Brahma is saying here, you appear to the world, you descend to the world, avatar, which is another astonishing feature, no? Like the transcendental personality coming into the world among us, but not being touched by the world. That's particularly interesting them. And to benefit all jivas. Brahma is including himself among one of them. Now at this moment, Brahma is feeling, you came to the world to benefit me. I'm so in need of your grace, and you're standing right in front of me. Now the idea that you come to the world to benefit everyone is making full sense. It makes full sense to me, because now I'm feeling how much I need your grace and how much I'm receiving that. So, some ideas regarding yesterday's verse. You can hear the hour and a half class. I won't repeat the whole thing. I'm always tempted to do so, but anyhow. So today we will start a new section, because the 40 prayers somehow are divided in different sections. So the first 7 verses were a kind of particular theme, where Brahma was speaking about the glories of bhakti and how different processes dependent on bhakti, but bhakti is independent, and so on. And now we'll start a new section where Brahma will express himself with full humility and remorse and repentance and different emotions, while acknowledging realizing his aparat, basically. So today we will continue with the 8th verse, arguably the most famous verse of the whole Brahma Stuti. So no need for a whiteboard. I trust all of you know it by heart, so there's no problem. Basically, this verse will speak about what we are expected to do if we want to receive Krishna's mercy, that I hope we want. But again, it's easier said than done. Everyone can say, I want Krishna's mercy. But we may not be fully like aware of the implications of that. What's Krishna's mercy? What's my part on that, on the equation? How to deal? I will show through my example that I actually want Krishna's mercy, and not just Krishna give me mercy. I mean, everyone can do that. We can train the parrot to repeat that, but you have to walk the talk, basically, to walk the prayer. So we will go to this verse. Before going to the verse, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions, like, in between verses, till the previous verse, 7th verse, Brahma has rejected other processes and accepted bhakti as the means to attain Bhagavan. I mean, he has shown karma, jnana, yoga there to attain other goals, but if you want to attain Bhagavan, and specifically this form of Bhagavan that I want to attain, Brahma is saying, bhakti is the means, and bhakti is the goal. Bhaktya sanjatya bhaktya. So now that he has established bhakti is the means, now he starts to describe how bhakti plays out. Okay, bhakti is the process. Okay, if you are to embrace bhakti, how you will behave if you are a bhakta in connection to, because bhakti has to do, what does Krishna say in the Gita? Mahatmanastu mam partam daivim prakriti mashritaha. So mahatma or a devotee is he who puts himself or herself under the shelter of the divine energy or divine nature, daivim prakriti or swarup shakti, bhakti. So the idea is, how does such a person behaves? No. If you say, okay, I want to remain under the shelter and mercy of Krishna, how will I show, not necessarily to the world, but to me, to Krishna, that I'm doing that with integrity, basically, and not just like as a show to convince others or even to convince myself that I'm doing that while I'm not actually doing that. And please don't try to convince Krishna, because he will very easily realize what you're doing. So all this has to do with having, yeah, authenticity, integrity, sincerity. This is a very interesting verse. Now when we were doing Gaurangi Priya was singing, I was also, I don't know, that was not in my mind, but some ideas came regarding the verse. And somehow each one of the four lines of the verse, and I still have not shared the verse, but started to connect in my mind with each one of the four lines of the third verse of Shikshastakam. And there is an interesting connection there. So that may also explain why this verse is quite important. So it says like this. This verse number 8 is in Indra Bajra. That's the name of the chanda or the meter of this verse. I'll share the verse in the thread for those online. For those here, I fully trust your panditness. Or if someone else says, Tati nukampam shushamikshamano bhunjana evatma kritam vipakam ridbad bapur bhir vidadham namaste jiveta yomokti pade sadai bhag. So, with the translation, and also we'll share it here. It says, therefore, and of course we will connect with the previous verse, therefore, a person who earnestly anticipates your grace, Brahma speaking to Krishna, all the while patiently enduring the results of his own past deeds, and who lives by bowing down to you with his heart, speech, and body, inherits you, the ultimate refuge of liberation. So, inherent or inherited? This verse is confirming. Yeah, that's another topic. So this is a verse. This is a very well-known one. Yeah, welcome. So, let's share some thoughts about this. Brahma is basically again saying, someone, let me make this connection with the third verse of Shikshastakam to begin with, because that's the most fresh thing that came to my mind just minutes ago. So first line of the verse say, let's go to the word by word first and then we connect the dots. First line say, Tatte nukampam shushamikshamano. So Tatte nukam, Tat means in this case, it's an abbreviation for Tashmat, which is like, therefore. So again, it's connected to, we'll see what the Acharya said, it's connected to the previous verse. Remember, previous verse, Brahma said, you come to the world to show mercy to everyone. So now he says, therefore, those who want that mercy, behave like this. Because again, he says, oh, you come to give mercy to all. But, okay, you come to give mercy to all, but who actually received that mercy? Because you may be willing to give mercy to everyone, but I mean, you have to do something on your side. Like Srila Sri Maharaj will say, I remember when I heard that quote, I almost fell to the ground straight with my head. He said, the only thing that Krishna is requesting from us is just a little bit of collaboration to accept the gift that he wants to give us. That's our part. Like if I want to give you the topmost valuable gift and I tell you, you tell me what's the price, you just have to put your hand to receive it. And you may, that's so difficult sometimes. Too. I'm like, I don't know. Who knows if you will give me a gift or what? No? Like this famous picture of painting of the Michelangelo's, I think. No? God is like trying to touch, give grace. Yeah. No? And we are on the other side. I mean, at least Padmanabha Maharaj is on the other side of the painting. And he's like... let's see, I don't know. I have to think about it. And God is like extending as much as he can, like, oh, try, just touch, some contact. You're like, I don't know if you deserve to be touched by my whatever thing. So anyhow. Tat te nu kampam shushamik shamana. So tat te, te means your, tat means therefore, te means your, anukampa is like anugraha or kripa, karuna, mercy. So te anukampa means your mercy, shu shamik shamana. So shamikshamana means like desiring, wanting, and shu shamikshamana means desiring it a lot. No? Like when you say sudurlava, sudurlava, this su generally means very. No? So susamikshamana, those who very earnestly want your mercy, that's the first line. No? So I connected that with Trinada Pisanichena, because first line speaks about humility. So somehow, no, for saying I need mercy, I want mercy, there has to be some humility. And for really desiring mercy, su shamikshamana, there has to be lots of humility, like that of the grass. To another piece in his head. So the second line says, bunjana evatma kritam vipakam. Bunjana means, again, those who want your mercy, bunjana means enduring. Eva atma, eva means only. Atma kritam basically means done by oneself. And vipakam. Vipakam means like the result. So such people who very eagerly want your mercy, they endure the results of their previous actions, basically. So that has to do with the second line of the third verse of Sikshastakam. Tarora pisahishuna. Tolerance like that of a tree. No? You have to tolerate. But as we know, the tree tolerates in a very unique way. The tree is not just tolerating. Okay, someday it will end. But while tolerating, the tree is giving. Shade, fruit, air, shelter, giving, giving, giving. Tolerating is like secondary. It's first and foremost giving. So that's what in the third verse, in the third line, this will be also further qualified. Hrit bat bapur bir bidadan namaste. How is that your devotees are those who want your mercy and who tolerate the result of their past deeds? Tolerate, which is the standard of tolerance, hrit bak bapur bir bidadam namaste. So hrit, basically in this case, means heart. Hrit, hridya. Hrit bak means speech. Bapur means body. So with their heart, with their speech, and with their body, bapur bihi, which means all this together, bidadam namaste. Te means to you, and bidadam namaha means they're offering obeisances to you. Like they respect you, they glorify you with all their functions. Meanwhile, tolerating. That's how they tolerate. That's the point. It's not like I have to tolerate so I'm too disturbed tolerating for thinking about Krishna and speaking about Him. Whenever this stuff that I have to tolerate stops, then I can speak about Krishna and glorify Him. No, 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 no. Meanwhile, that's the best way to do that. Because why? As we will see. Because the devotee will feel, actually what I have to tolerate is nothing in comparison to what I should be tolerating. But Krishna is so merciful that I'm only receiving this. So I conclude in such a way, so I start to glorify Krishna. Oh, how merciful He is with my body, my words. So that has a lot to do with the third line of Sikshastakam. Amani nama nadena. To offer respect and not expect respect to oneself. Namaste. Offer respect with body, mind, words. Third line. And the last line of the verse, Brahma is saying, mentioning which is the result if you live your life in such a way. Basically, he's saying, Jibeta jamukti pade sadayabak. So he's saying, Jibeta means, Jibeta ya. Ya means anyone who, and Jibeta means lives. So whoever lives in such a way, as described above, mukti pade sadayabak. Sa means he or she. Mukti pade and dayabak. Mukti pade can mean many things, as we will see. That's a very important word. Basically means, pade means, can mean position, can be feet. Mukti means liberation. And dayabak means like the recipient of an inheritance, something like that. So that person becomes the inheritor of liberation, or the feet of liberation, of the position of liberation. And eventually we will see how this idea of Muktipade means ultimately Krishna. In whom liberation, at whose feet liberation takes shelter. So basically the conclusion of Brahma is, such people inherit you. No, you become their inheritance. Mm-hmm. So that may be connected with the last line of Sikshastika. No? Kirtaniya Sadahari. Perpetually engaging in kirtan. That's the inheritance we receive. No? Bhakti for the sake of further bhakti. Mm-hmm. So that's it. I'll share with you now Bhaktivedanta Bhavanubad, which is, as I mentioned these days, a very interesting commentary that our Guru Maharaj has made to the Brahma Stuti. If you may ask me where is this coming from, that will be in his forthcoming book, and he very generously shared that with me to share that with you. So that's his generosity, not mine. I'm just extending his generosity, and that's what I'm trying to do, you know, every moment, hopefully. So I'll read that first, and then we will go to the commentaries of the previous acharyas, Sridhar Swami, Sanatana Goswami, and so on. So Guru Maharaj says like this, thus, Brahma concludes this section of his eulogy focused on the efficacy of bhakti with the obvious. Simply loving Krishna is by far the best course of action. And it is comparatively easy to do, given his compassion for his devotees to begin with. One who serves him steadfastly as a lifestyle, accepting whatever happiness or distress one experiences as either that which one is due in consideration of one's diminishing prarabdha karma, or as Krishna's arrangement to draw one closer to him, inherits the treasure of the shelter of his liberated lotus feet. His devotees spend their lives in this way, rather than performing severe austerities and penances with the great physical and mental effort required on other paths. They simply serve him instead, and that according to their means, endeavoring only for his grace. Guru Maharaj ki jai. So that's Bhavanubad, no? Like the gist of the verse, according to also other commentaries in his own words and mood. So before going to some other commentaries, of course, we'll try to share some thoughts in between. This is a very important verse, very practical one, very like the third verse of Sikshastika. At least for me, it's a very it's a kind of a thermometer for where I am standing at any single moment, you know, especially when one may be a little bit, for whatever reason, I don't know, disturbed or on a cloudy day or whatever is going on. You just think about this verse and you will see what can be adjusted and how you can be better situated to deal with whatever circumstances. Generally, all of us can increase our humility, tolerance, and respect and modesty a little bit, always. Generally, that is generally, you know, maybe too exceptional that you say, no, Maharaj, I've done the introspective analysis and I've realized that I cannot be more humble at this moment, more than what I'm being now. That's not so humble to begin with. No. I cannot be more tolerant than what I'm being now. Not a speck more. I said, like, are you sure? And I cannot be more respectful, and I cannot be more modest. I mean, generally, again, if we are sincere, we will realize I can do that a little bit better. But the point is, why I'm not doing so? And maybe the fact that I'm not doing that thing that I can do, again, what I can do, I'm not speaking about what I cannot do yet, but what I can do now, and I'm not doing, that's what probably is creating your present disturbance in your mind. If you have some disturbance, you think about those terms. Which are those things? that I can do, I know I should do, but I'm not doing. And what if I do that? Make the test. No, try to do those things that you know you can do and you should do and you are not doing. Try to do them and see the result. Probably the disturbance you had at least diminishes, and maybe disappears totally. So the point is how much good students we are and how much we are doing our homework. And the homework updates every single day. Yesterday's homework is not today's homework. So that's a pretty demanding school and teacher we have. But that's the price for transcendence. Again, we are starting gradually here to glimpse what's the price to pay for Krishna's mercy. Again, it's not priceless. It's costless. Costless from our side. From his side, there is a cost in his heart. No? But from our side, we didn't do anything. But there is something we have to do to honor that properly again. Because the fact that we receive something we do not deserve doesn't mean that already that we are taking advantage of that. I can give you something you do not deserve, and if you may not know what to do with that and you just throw that there, and you receive that, but you threw that below the piano there. So it's similar, no? Krishna is giving you mercy. You don't deserve that, but it doesn't mean that you're taking advantage of that either. So how we can take advantage of the mercy that already came to our lives? Sometimes we may think about getting more mercy, and it becomes some kind of like, I need more. As we generally think about other things, I need more. You are not yet taking advantage of what you already have, but you're just thinking, I need more. And what will happen when I have this and when I have that? You may just like move that same criteria to the realm of costless mercy and think, I need more mercy. And when Krishna will give me this mercy and this mercy. And we already have the whole plan fixed in our mind. No? Which type of mercy Krishna should give me, in which way, and which will be the result of that. And it doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. Probably the real mercy we need is not at all what we think Krishna should give us. No? Another term, actually, what Krishna thinks we need, he already gave us. And maybe we are not taking advantage of that. So we are thinking, when that day will be mine? And Krishna is asking, when on that day will be yours that you realize what I gave you and you take advantage of that? And stop asking for more while you are not know what to do with the thing I already sent you. And we all laugh, instead of crying. But basically, you know my point. You get my point. And as I sometimes say, we ask Krishna, give me mercy, and Krishna gives us mercy. But we already had such a conditioned idea of how Krishna should respond to our prayer that we idealize, mercy should come in this particular packaging. But Krishna disagrees with that. He knows what do we actually need. So he shows mercy. I mean, we don't know how to show mercy to ourselves generally. But Krishna knows. So he sends what he knows is mercy for us. But we misread his mercy sometimes. And we start to pray to Krishna, Krishna protect me from this thing. And he said, that's the mercy I just sent you. that's my reply to your previous prayer. And now you are praying to me to counteract the result of your previous prayer. It's not working like this. And probably I reply again and you will start to pray. I mean, you will keep praying to me. That's nice. But praying to me so I counteract my reply to your previous prayer. That's not the idea here. No. So this verse starts to show ideally how we should be disposed in this connection. This verse saying, the devotees are seeing all these arrangements, whatever is coming to their life. All these arrangements are none different from my master, basically. And that's a nice word. Krishna is not different from his qualities and body. He's not different from the arrangements he's sending to my life in order to redeem me. I don't have to forget, Rakshishati Bishvaso, Krishna is protecting his devotees. That's a crucial aspect of Saranagati. Krishna will protect me. No? That idea, that line is not saying Krishna may protect me. It's Krishna will protect me. Bas. Period. Krishna says that in the Gita over and over again. Yoga kshimam bahamyaham ananya shintayantu. I'll give my devotee what he needs she needs. I'll provide what they lack, and I take away what's not necessary. Full comprehensive treatment. Preserving what is needed, giving what it lacks, taking away what... But sometimes we are more like, I want to keep what I don't need. I don't want to include what I need. So we have to agree with the terms and conditions when we sign up for the mercy department, basically. We have to accept. Anukulya sankalpa pratikulya savarjanam. Again, all these limbs of Saranagati speak about this verse. Accept those things that are favorable for bhakti. Anukulya sankalpa means probably those things which... To accept those things that are favorable for bhakti, also you may have to accept, I still don't feel favorable, those things which are actually favorable. That's part of accepting that things which are favorable. It's not only, oh, I accept the favorable thing. First, maybe to accept what is favorable, not to accept the favorable, to accept what is favorable and accept it. Not just acknowledge, yeah, that's favorable. And do you accept that? That's favorable. You accept that? So accept those things in your life. And probably acknowledge, oh, I have my list upside down. In the anukul list, I have full of practical stuff, unfavorable. And the practical list, unfavorable, I have full of anukul stuff. What is actually unfavorable, I'll tell you that's unfavorable and vice versa. That's embarrassing, Krishna, my God. And Krishna says, nice, nice. You're starting to awaken. That's part of the process. So basically, the spirit of this verse in the words of Srila Sridhar Maharaj is, and again, it's easier said than done. I'm in this comfortable sofa here instructing all of you, telling what to do. I mean, and as I always say, after this type of classes, Krishna say, oh, you say all those nice things in the lecture. Let's see how much you walk the talk. Okay. I should stop giving that many classes. So Srila Simraj will say, this verse saying, there are no problems, there are only service opportunities. Again, easier said than done. But we have to begin at least saying that, to remind us. There are no problems. No problems. Krishna says in the Gita, Masu Chaha at the beginning, Masu Chaha at the end, do not worry. There are no problems. If you surrender to me, there are no problems. I take care of you. The problem is that we don't have faith in that. If you still perceive problems, means we don't have faith that there are no problems. The problem is our lack of faith. It sounds so easy that it's difficult to believe, maybe, for us. Krishna says, I take full charge of you, no more problem. If you really believe that, you surrender to that. No? As Jiva Goswami said, no? Surrender is the outer symptom of faith. Sharanagati is the external expression of Shraddha. And Sharanagati means Anukulya Sankalpa Pratikulya Savardhana Rakshi Chati Vishwasu. So only service opportunities. No? In other words, what I perceive as a problem, I perceive it as such because I don't want to serve. Basically, you follow my point. I mean, if I will want to serve, there are no problems. But if I feel something is a problem, is this thing is inviting me to serve, but I don't want to serve. So I feel this is a problem. This is an obstacle to my non-service disposition. And the situation comes to invite you for service disposition. So if you agree with that, there is no problem. But if we feel problem, actually we ourselves are presenting the obstacle. It's not that the thing is an obstacle, but we are an obstacle to reality. We are trying to walk. If we behave like that, I mean, I'm not saying you are an obstacle to reality, but when we behave as such, yeah, we are against the nature of reality, which is reality has a center and we are to serve that center. If you don't agree with that, in practice, not just, I agree with that, Maharaj, let's see. I mean, I won't say let's see, but reality will say, let's see. And then as they say, reality, life happens. No? So we have to play out our beliefs. No, because I believe in God, but if you in practice, you can behave as an atheist in practice. Or we can say, we don't follow Shankaracharya, but in practice you may be impersonalist in so many ways. If you don't want to take full responsibility of you as an individual and just try to merge your face in the crowd and not think for yourself, you are somehow promoting Advaita Vedanta, unofficially. In the name of a Vaishnava, that's even more dangerous. At least be brave enough and subscribe to Shankaracharya and say, okay, let's go to Brahman. Something like that. No? To Rakshi Shyat Vishwaso, no? This class will be long, just in case, for you to know. Mm-hmm. Not because of notes here, but because of what may be coming. There is a lot to say. No? So, so ideally we should have this type of humility, this type of tolerance, where whatever comes to our lives, and I know I'm saying this, and hopefully you are processing this in a very specific way according to what's going on in your life, which I don't have a clue. I mean, in some cases I may have a clue, in some other cases not so much. But this is to be applied to the specifics of our daily life. So, so the idea, in very generic terms, is everything God is doing in my life somehow is for some reason. But these verses go beyond that, and basically saying, whatever is happening, Srila Samaraswan say that. To say everything God does for some reason, that's still generic. Let's go be more specific. He said, this verse is saying, whatever is happening to you is the best thing that could possibly happen. That's like, oh my God. Because generally I may think, this is the worst thing that could be happening to me. But according to Shastra, this is the best thing that should be happening to me. So the point is, why I'm not perceiving that as the best thing? And of course, someone like Srila Siddhar Maharaj will tell us, trying to change your angle of vision. Mm-hmm. And that's so painful. No, because we want reality to adjust to our angle of vision. No? But as Guru Maharaj will say, you want reality to change to adjust to you, but you yourself are not even comfortable with you. No? He's saying that's quite paradoxical. Generally, we move in life expecting that the whole world adjusts to us, but we ourselves are not comfortable enough with us. We want the whole world to fit in our mind, but we don't feel we are fitting in our mind either. So if there is no even place for me, how do I expect the whole world to enter and find some corner there and fit there? It makes no sense. So it's important to try to change your angle of vision. Again, it's a simple poetic line, but lots of sweating is required. Like Guru Maharaj will say, if you want some water to come to you, like in the form of ecstatic tears, first try to invoke water in the form of this type of sweating. First try to sweat by working on this type of thing. Then tears will come and all that stuff, basically. You know? But basically, the idea of these verses, whatever is happening in your life is the best possible thing that could be happening, because a devotee thinks, according to what I did in the past, I should be receiving this particular, how to say in English, sentence, if you want to put it in legal terms. But Krishna is so merciful that he has reduced it to whatever is coming here in this way. So instead of complaining, instead of being discouraged or depressed, you are actually grateful and thinking, oh my gosh, I'm so fortunate. This is such a gift. So you end up glorifying Krishna instead of saying, oh, why this is all happening to me and so on. Silasimras will say also, and I'm quoting him a lot because he loves to quote this verse. And he will say that the gist of this verse, today's verse, is the environment is friendly. There are no enemies outside. Weak faith requires an enemy, he will say. But strong faith realizes, if there's an enemy, it's my own mind. And Krishna says that in the Gita. Vandurat matmanastasya janatmanai bandhita. If you control your mind, that's your best friend. If you don't control your mind, that's your worst enemy. There are no other enemies. But the uncontrolled mind is the worst enemy, because why? Because it will show enemies all around you. That's the worst enemy. The ones who convince you it's full of enemies out there. And you are the victim. Oh, poor you. Nobody understands a victim consciousness. Krishna consciousness, the exact opposite to victim consciousness. So, and Krishna is saying, mind can be the worst enemy, but has the potential to be the best friend. So if at present your mind is worst enemy, you have a very nice challenge. You try to convert your worst enemy into your best friend. That's not so easy. No. Like when Jesus Christ say, love your enemies. That's not an easy one. If I tell you love your friends, you say, I'm already doing that. That's easy. Love your friends, love your kids, love your enemies. And you say, I kind of love my enemy. Because it's my enemy. So maybe you have to make your enemy a friend, and then you can love him. Oh, yeah. That's the idea of love your enemy. I mean, you cannot love your enemy if you still see the person as an enemy. That means what I see as an enemy has to be seen from another perspective, so I can love it. And that's like the obsession of a devotee. How can I adjust my angle of vision so I can love everything and everyone? Because the more I see enemies, I can love in that direction. I won't feel love is coming. There's only fear, calculation, and all this type of neurosis. But this verse is trying to give us this idea. The environment is friendly. Technically, strictly speaking, the nature of reality is there are no enemies outside. So at least we have to believe this in theory, although in practice it may seem a little bit far, but try to understand that's what's going on in reality. So I want to be aligned with reality. How much peace will there be if I do not perceive any enemies, basically. Anyhow, let's continue with the commentaries. I never started even with the single one, first one. Sridhar Swami, first commentary. He's saying, therefore, only bhakti makes sense. That's his commentary. That's interesting. Therefore, considering all that has been said in the previous verses, he said, this is the substance of the verse. This bhakti makes full sense, therefore. Because of how merciful Krishna is. And therefore, since it makes so much sense, I behave accordingly. Sridhar Swami also said that Tatyenu kampam, which means while expecting your compassion, susamikshamano, means that the devotee thinking, when Krishna you will show your mercy to me? Like implying, the person remains in a certain mood, in a certain spirit, like sincerely expecting that, praying for that, feeling the need for that. We need to feel the need for mercy. It's not just like some cheap transaction, like, give me some mercy, I need some mercy, here $2 and mercy here. No, we are trying to connect with something that is not from this world. That it's beyond us, but we need it. Again, this is a principle of grace. I do not deserve it, but I need it. So I need to take a certain stance. Imagine that, I need something, but I don't deserve that. But I need it. But I don't deserve that. But I need it. And I could continue saying the same thing for an hour. But I don't deserve it, but I need it. So which stance am I supposed to take if I'm to knock on the door on that department? Asking for something, I know I don't need it, I don't deserve it, and no matter what I do, I will never deserve it. It's not that at present I don't deserve it, but someday I will acquire enough merit to deserve costless grace. No, that doesn't happen. If you really understand what's mercy, you will understand, I no matter what I do, I will never deserve it. But I need it. So you will go to that door in a certain disposition. The more you realize how much you depend on that and how less you deserve that, I mean, that combination will make you approach and, again, this spirit, when I will receive that from you? I am so needy, please. Bhakti no taku will sing kavi havi. Oh, when all that day will be mine. Oh, when that will come to me and he will cry. And real prayer will create that effect. Tears will naturally come from our eyes. And of course, again, we are asking for something very high, so that's not something that we should also demand. It has to come as quick as possible, because we are asking the highest of the highest, because we need that. Not because we are the highest of the highest. We are the lowest of, I am the lowest of the lowest, and that's why I need the highest of the highest, to be redeemed from my position. So how to obtain such inheritance? Sridhar Swami says, well, the only way to gain an inheritance, because the verse is using the word inheritance, dayabak, how do you obtain an inheritance? Let's go to earthly human legal terms. How you will receive your grandmother's inheritance?
When she dies.
And what do you have to do? Not only kill her, something else. Black human. On your side, what can you do? And you have to remain alive, basically, and to wait. Of course, you can leave your body before and no inheritance, and that's all. But upon the only way you can gain inheritance is just to live out your life. So similarly, he is saying the only way you can get inheritance of liberation in the form of Krishna's feet, live out your life as a proper devotee, engaging your body, mind, heart, while dealing with the result of your previous actions. You continue with your life in this way. That's the best way of passing your days. As Guru Maharaj would like always to say, Ajudharati bhai punshamu dhyanaschanchayanaso syartikshatranonito tamashloka vartaya. Every single day the sun rises and what? Sets. So what's the meaning of that? One day less. One day less. One day less. For those who are just not aware of what's the meaning of that movement. But if you are using your time for understanding that message and therefore reaching the conclusion of Uttama Shloka Vartaya, of serving your source, actually there's time is not affecting you anymore. And you will not be afraid basically of time, which means you won't be afraid of death. A devotee proper is not afraid of death. I mean, death is no longer an issue because time is not affecting that person. In one sense, a devotee, an immersed devotee, is even living this life with his or her eyes on the next life. Not as an evasion, you say? Evasive mechanism to the present day responsibilities. I'm not saying, I'm not promoting that. Just think about your next life. Your kids, they will somehow find their way. No, I'm not saying that. But in some way, you know, okay, what I'm after as a goal is so big that it may take some time, and that has to do with eternity. So that's the next life I'm speaking about. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that, interestingly, in one song he writes. He already starts to mention what he will do in his next life. That sounds a little, for someone that may sound dysfunctional, but actually it's highly functional. So he's saying, well, in my next lifetime, I will be born in Bhoma Vrindavan. I will be born in Barsana. Of course, he's projecting his birth as Kamala Manjari and so on. Again, we cannot imitate Bhaktivinoda Thakur, but just an example of how a devotee is totally beyond death. I mean, his concern is not, will I die or not? But they're already making plans. I'll be born in Barsana, be moved to Yavat, I will get married there, and then I will serve Sri Radha there. So he already arranged his marriage in the previous lifetime. So death is not an issue for him. He knows, I'll have to go there, and I'll be there, and it's okay. You already have your marrying plan for the next life. That shows how much beyond time and the devotees are by living out their life accordingly now, at present. So again, that's the way you received inheritance. No? Let's see what Jiva Goswami has to say in this connection in Bhakti Sandarbha, 303 Anucheda. He says, just as a parent's property is inherited by their children, so too you become the Brahma is saying to Krishna, so too you become the inheritance of such a devotee. In other words, you willingly come under the devotee's control. Mm-hmm. Like eventually the inheritance is in your control, if you will. You can do with that money what you want, if you will. Somehow Krishna becomes the inheritance of the devotee, and he is totally under the control of his devotee. Chaitanya Charitamrita basically says that, no? Whatever a devotee wants from his master, Krishna, without a doubt, he's granting that, because, and this line, nice line from Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna has no other duty to apart from fulfill the desire of his devotee. That's his job. He has nothing else to do than to fulfill the desire of his devotee. That's who he is. That he's concerned. Try to understand who is Krishna. No? Because sometimes we just say Krishna, Krishna, and we are not aware who he is, which is his concern. Because we are too much overburdened by our own concerns. So sometimes to think which is Krishna's concern, that will relieve us so much of our own concerns. He's only concerned about his devotees. Oh. Mm. So I should only be concerned about him. That makes things much more simple. Mm. So we can inherit Krishna. Mm. And again, the medium for inheriting Krishna is bhakti. Mm. So if Krishna is an inheritance, bhakti is so as well. Mm. So he continues, Jiva Goswami, in Bhakti Sandarbha 303. This is a chapter where he's interestingly describing Vandanam. Vandanam means two things, prayers and obeisances. Can mean both, the same term for the two things. So in the context of what to pray, and how to offer pranam, he's quoting this verse from the Bhagavatam, like an example of how to do so. So Jiva Goswami is saying, mentioned that the first word of this verse, tatenu kampantab, again, it's an abbreviation of tashmat, which means therefore, and creates some syntactical connection between the previous verse and this one. Implying, again, previous verse, Rama said, you are endowed with transcendental qualities, and you descend to the world for the benefit of every living being. Therefore, the devotees reciprocate with that, with body, mind, words. Tanuvan manovir, aham tabashmi. I'm yours with body, mind, and words. That's a classical line. I'm yours with body, mind, and words. Aham tabashmi. And Baladev Vidyabhushan clarifies it very interestingly. He says, but they do so not excessively agonizing because of vows. No? So the devotees surrender to you and offer everything to you, but in such a way that they are not agonizing because of accepting some extreme vow, that they are going neurotic about sustaining the vow, and, offering everything to. So he's making this point here. No? Be careful of not like over, how do you say, exerting? I don't know. Yeah? Huh?
Yeah.
Okay, you get the idea.
Yeah, over endeavoring.
Yeah, whatever, no? Yeah, over-demanding yourself and end up being like in the name of whatever. So we should give ourselves to Krishna, but in a way that is sustainable to us. Mm-hmm. But sustainable doesn't mean complacent. No? I mean, it has to be outside of the comfort zone. But not that outside of the comfort zone either, because you will drown out. No? So, in a tatasta, between, I mean, not in the comfort zone, but also not throwing you too much in the non-comfort zone, because that may be neurosis for you. But we need some challenging, of course. I mean, real learning only happens outside of the comfort zone. You cannot learn anything substantial from the comfort zone. That can't happen, basically, because it's comfort zone. It's a zone just to do what I'm doing. Sit in the sofa here. No? Very comfortable. No? That's why the speaker... You are supposed to learn, so you are not sitting in the comfort of the sofa. You are thrown out of the comfort zone. Just sit on the floor and learn something. and I'm the guy here instructing the whole people in this comfort zone. So you may doubt the quality of my teaching, the nature of my teaching by being here. But what's that? So let's share some words about this idea of muktipade, because that's an important word of this verse. Let's switch in that direction. So the word mukti means liberation. And Srimad Bhagavatam presents 10 main subjects, the ninth of which is mukti. There are 9 subjects called ashrita, 1 subject called ashraya. So ashraya means the shelter, ashrita means the sheltered. So 10 subjects are sheltered in the shelter. The shelter is Krishna, samam bonum, you say in English? Ashraya, the shelter. And everything else is sheltered in him. Sarga, visarga, all these topics. Mukti. Mukti is one of them. So, Jiva Goswami says that pada here, mukti pade, refers to the complete manifestation of this 10th subject, or ashraya. So, in other words, mukti pade will mean, pade means ashraya, and mukti means mukti. So, the ashraya of mukti. You will obtain the shelter of liberation, which is, again, Krishna and his lotus feet. Bhakti is giving mukti, as Brahma already explained, not vice versa. Mukti is not giving bhakti. Mukti is not sheltering bhakti. Bhakti is sheltering mukti. And of course, famous story in this connection I will just share briefly, because that can be a whole different lecture, with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and this particular word, and this particular verse. As we know, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was the topmost logician who lived in Jagannath Puri at the time Mahaprabhu arrived him. That was basically the first day of Mahaprabhu in Puri, was the conversion of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. That was his glorious arrival. I mean, he converted the greatest intellectual of the world in his first day. I mean, in 7 days. But the first day started the whole conversion process. So eventually, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, as we know, he turned out to be a total passionate, devotional follower of Mahaprabhu, from being a dry head-like guy to just jumping and dancing with Mahaprabhu. Not just sentimentally, but grounded in knowledge for sure. So Mahaprabhu wanted to test the degree of the Bhattacharya's conversion. So as we know, first next day he was converted, he comes like 3 in the morning. So Sarvabhauma was still sleeping, and Mahaprabhu comes to his bed with Jagannath Mahaprasad. Say, look, Sarvabhauma, what I brought, Jagannath Mahaprasad. And he was waiting to see. Let's see what the Bhattacharya does now. If his smarter sensibilities warn him out of what's going on, because generally he will, according to the Karma Kanda, smart as Brahmin he was, oh no, first I have to bathe and have the morning duties and my bandhana and this, and then I can eat something. He will say that before being converted by Mahaprabhu. But now, he says, Jagannath Mahaprasad, Sarvabhauma just did not even open his eyes. He took Mahaprasad from the bed, just like, breaking all Brahminical social rules that you can imagine for someone of his stature, without bathing, cleaning your teeth, going to the bathroom, taking your sheets out. No, just Jai Jagannath. No. Mahaprabhu was like, okay, test one, approved. See you tomorrow for test number 2. Actually, that was, Mahaprabhu didn't have to test Sarvabhauma. He himself came with the Bhagavatam. And he came with the Bhagavatam in hand with this verse we are studying today. And there was one scratching in the Bhagavatam. and say, I don't like this word, he said, Sarvabhauma. Which word? Say, mukti. And Mahaprabhu was like, but you liked that word so much some days ago. You were all after mukti. I mean, you were just, I mean, mukti is the all in all. I don't care for anything else. I mean, as Guru Maharaj will say, if you want mukti, you have to care for that only, for that in such a way that you have to discard everything else from this world to desire that so intensely. So that's an intense desire, because all the desires here are so intense, but to desire mukti has to be more intense than all these desires put together. And Sarvabhauma was the Atari of that. And now he was saying, I don't like even to read the word. But to hear that and to pursue that. I'm just reading. And Mahaprabhu said, but that's in the Bhagavatam, right? Yes. But this It's distasteful, mukti. Ugh. After I receive your grace, that's what Prabhupada Nanda Saraswati says. Now, it sounds a little bit intense. He's more intense than Sarvabhauma, for sure. Prabhupada Nanda Saraswati says, how is the verse? We learned it together 4 years ago. Why you laugh? Whatever verse we learn, we have to memorize. That's not just learn for the...
There's a lot of
ayate
in it.
Oh, kaivalyam narakayate. Yeah, that's the main part that I was asking for. So I'm not that bad. It's a long one, but it begins there. Kaivalyam narakayate. Tridashapur akashapushpayate. But yeah, kaivalyam narakayate. Prabhupada said, for he who has received the merciful silent glance of Mahaprabhu, from that person, the idea of mukti, kaivalyam mukti, narakayate, is hell. It's like hell, hellish. With all respect to Advaita Vedanta, but Prabhupada is speaking intensely. So again, before that, oh, I was all into that. Now, But Mahaprabhu is saying, that's a word in the Bhagavatam. You're going to just scratch the Bhagavatam, change the word in the Bhagavatam. So that's when Mahaprabhu is explaining to him, actually, mukti pade means he at whose feet mukti is taking shelter. So the verse speaking about Krishna is not speaking about mukti as you used to think of it. So almost like, okay. We'll keep the verse as it is. Bhagavat, Srimad Bhagavatam, as it is. And Jiva Goswami also say mukti can refer to these things, can refer to divine love, can refer to he who is the object of the devotee's prem. In Srimad Bhagavatam 5.19.20, prem is described as real liberation. Because mukti means still I have one desire. I want to be liberated. Still there is some separate desire. I want liberation. In prem you don't have separate desire. It's I want to serve Krishna. So, you follow my point? Mm-hmm. So mukti means liberation from all these desires, but still there is this strong desire. That's why the Bhagavatam say, akama sarva kama va moksha kama udharadi. No, he say, whether you have all the desires in the world, or you have only one desire, moksha kama, or you have no desire, which means bhakti. Technically, you don't have desire in bhakti for you, separate. No? In karma, you have all desires. You want to swallow the whole world and enjoy it for you in one single piece. If you are mukti, you don't have all the desires of the world. You have no desire for the world, but you still have one desire. I want mukti. And that's a pretty intense one, more intense than all the other ones. But if you have bhakti, akama, you don't have any desire for you. Anyavilasita sanyam. So the point is, mukti still... it's liberation from certain desires, but still we need liberation from liberation, from the desire of liberation. We need mukti from mukti. So in that sense, prema means mukti, or mukti means prema. No, your ultimate freedom, your ultimate redemption, emancipation means divine love. You are even free from that separate desire. I want to get free from this place. Still, you are the center of that, as my Guru Maharaj would like to think. Some people think, I want to enjoy the world. And other people think, I want to get rid of the world. But still, you are the center. I want to enjoy. I want to get rid. Still, the I want slaves you. But in bhakti, it's what Krishna wants. It's not the I want. No, like once one devotee approaches his guru and says, Gurudev, yes. I want, stop. Say, wrongly formulated. Formulate the question again. Don't start with I want. You don't want to your guru in that way, basically. It's what you want. How I can serve you. The guru will approach you like that. I remember once I wrote to Guru Maharaj. I don't know, those moments that you... it was just an exchange via chat in Facebook, but it was pretty epiphany-like. And I said, good morning, Guru Maharaj. And he replied, how can I serve you today? He was like, okay, yeah, this is my guru. So that's the point. No? Do not go to your guru, I want. You're asking why, how can I serve you today? Why? Because he is asking you that question. That's his heart disposition. how can I serve you today? Even though he may not say it every single day with those words, that's the background of whatever that is going on. So don't forget that thing, so we act as proper disciples. Another series altogether. Guru Tattva. So in this way, Srila Jiva Goswami concludes in this way. You know, basically, mukti refers to mukti here cannot refer to mukti as mere liberation. He gives an interesting idea. Also, he says mukti pade in this verse cannot refer to mukti, ordinary quote unquote mukti, because, and he quotes a verse from Shastra. It is said that by only offering pranam only once to Vishnu, you attain mukti. No? So he quotes one verse from Vishnu Dharma. If you only once offering pranam to Vishnu once, you obtain mukti. But this verse is describing someone who constantly is offering pranam to Vishnu with body, mind, hearts. So if mukti is the reward for someone who only once does that, there must be a higher reward than mukti for those who are constantly doing that in the midst of such a circumstance. And of course, yes, there is. That's bhakti, that's prem. But again, interestingly, this verse, as Jiva Goswami presents, is in the context of bandana, offering prayers. So he says, by only, quote-unquote, offering prayers to Bhagavan, you can attain prem. That's one of the nine limbs of bhakti. If you only pray to God sincerely, you can attain prem by doing that. Of course, in a proper way. I don't remember his name, but recently someone shared with me one book from one Christian author who wanted to go to live in the monastery, and he was given the service to offer pranam to all the people who was walking in the street passing the church. Mm-hmm. That was his service for a year. What service can I do? You go to the door and you just put your head in the ground toward every person that is coming in front of you. Something else? No, that's all. All day. 1 year. And he did it. And he wrote a whole book about all the realizations that he had by just doing that. And that's why in our tradition, unfortunately, that's not so present now in most. But there was part of the sadhana of the devotees. As we have a sadhana of chanting certain number of rounds, they have this sadhana of offering certain number of obeisances per day. By the hundreds or thousands, the Goswami had this standard. I mean, that's not just, of course, a mechanical thing, up and down, aerobic thing, like up and down. But if done with proper conception, that will create not only a movement of the body, but a movement in our hearts. And then Jiva Goswami starts to mention some details of how to offer pranam, not giving the front to the deity, not giving your right side, but left side. And for more, we have the Vaishnava Etiquette series there. You can go there. Okay. Jiva Goswami's commentary is done. Still, Sanatana Goswami is waiting. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Do you have time?
Yes.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. We have eternity? Okay. I'll try to be a little bit brief, but some minutes we have. Sanatana Goswami is saying, the devotee depicted here is not attached to happiness or distress in terms of experiencing the result of his previous misdeeds in the context of bhakti. So whatever comes to him, whether it may be the result of misbehavior, good behavior, I'm not attached to that. I'm practicing bhakti. That's my focus. Whatever comes as a result of my previous actions, okay, that's coming in the context of bhakti. That's the important thing. It's not so much, is that sweet? Is that bitter? Is that coming in connection to previous misdeed or nice, some piety idea? I don't care. I'm focusing bhakti. That should be the ideal determination. That's the type of tolerance that this verse is depicting. It's a higher level of tolerance than the one, for example, present in the Gita. And Krishna, in the second chapter, 14th verse, he's saying, Matras parsas tu kaunteya shitoshna shruka dukha daha agama panya nityastam stitikshasya bharata. One should tolerate happiness and distress. That's already pretty interesting idea. You go to the street and tell people, tolerate happiness. Like, whoa. I won't tolerate, I will enjoy happiness. No, no, you have to tolerate, materially speaking. Material happiness. Happiness and distress, tolerate, because it's just coming and going. It's like the seasons, he's saying, no? Like winter and summer and spring. I mean, do not get very happy because it's summer, because it will be winter. And you not get overtly sad because it's winter, because it will, spring is coming. But you don't get extremely happy because that will end us. So that means do not get extremely one thing nor extremely the other. Remain in the middle, understanding these things come and go. And I have nothing to do with them, technically speaking. So that's Gita's standard. Tolerate those things knowing they'll come and go. But this very standard is higher. It says, while all those things come, you are absorbing, glorifying Krishna with mind, body, and words. You are not just tolerating, knowing this will. Because you need knowledge to tolerate anything. If you don't know why to tolerate something, you won't tolerate. You will go crazy. If I tell you why to tolerate, you can't do it. But except, like, okay, I know I have coming and going. But here the devotee is not even coming and going, just absorbed in bhakti. And if you are really absorbed in bhakti, at one point you don't even feel I have to tolerate anything. You follow. For some people, you have to tolerate that situation. For other people, the same situation is not. They don't feel I have to tolerate anything. So when you really tolerate, there is a point that you no longer tolerate. Not because you became intolerant, but because you become trans-tolerant or something. You don't feel I have to tolerate. They have to tolerate me. So how can I think? Once my devotee told that, if it's difficult for you to tolerate, just think about Paramatma in your heart for unlimited lifetimes. It's still there. No, you never found it a sign saying, "I'm tired of this." No, I mean, so much nonsense for unlimited lifetime from another time. I mean, I'm getting out of here. Find another inner witness. Good luck. Good luck. No, still there, tolerating. So we are tolerated that much. We should tolerate as much. If not, it's not fair. I mean, if I'm being tolerated 100% and I just tolerate 20%, I mean, that doesn't work like that. And we are tolerated 108%. So that's why when Mahaprabhu says Tarora Pisa Ishuna, it's not, oh, that's too much. More tolerant than a tree. I mean, us, again, Paramatma, he's being more tolerant than a tree with you. So now just reciprocate accordingly. And I'm not saying that's easy. You know, I never use the word, this is easy for all of us. I never say that word because it's not. I mean, it's easy, but we are not easy. No, we are not easy fellows. So whatever is easy, like someone once said, oh, life is simple, but to be simple is quite difficult. No, quite complicated. But one definition of the devotee is Charalata, which means it's he who has simplicity. But that's not so easy. No? You have to integrate complexity. Sanatana Goswami also says another way of translating Muktipade, making some grammatical Sanskrit adjustment, is Muktipade can become Amuktipade. So Amuktipade means he who does the feat of he who does not give liberation to his devotees, which is another way of saying Krishna doesn't give mukti, because he knows the devotees do not want that, so he will be give bhakti. So you will attain the feat of he who won't give you liberation. So don't be afraid of that. He will give you bhakti. And he concludes saying, by drowning in the ocean of the Lord's sweet qualities, the devotees reject the drop of salt water known as liberation. So bhakti is ocean of sweet water, and liberation is a drop of salty water in comparison. Moksha laguta krit. Some few thoughts by Srila Jiva Goswami again, because I only mentioned Bhakti Sandarbha, but we didn't go to his commentary on the Bhagavatam, Lagu Vaishnav Toshni. So he's saying, okay. as only someone alive can inherit some property. We already mentioned that. Similarly, the devotee inherits Bhagavan because the devotee is really alive. That's the point also. Because alive doesn't mean just, I'm alive, I didn't kill myself, I have not suicidal tendencies. No, you have to be really nourishing your bhakti. Vibhavati says the same thing in the Bhagavad. Niha dat karma dharmayana viragaya kalpati natirta padasi vaya jivanam imbrita hisa. He whose execution of dharma doesn't take him to renunciation and whose renunciation doesn't take him to bhakti is dead although he's breathing. Which again is a strong words, but to make this point, what does it mean to be really alive if you are as an atma? To be connected with the function, with the potential of your soul. That's why the Shastra always uses the word atmaha or killer of the soul. You cannot kill the soul, but if you neglect the need of your soul, that's a way of putting you're killing yourself. You're not nourishing your attention. Rupa Goswami quotes here the Bhagavatam 10th canto, 87th chapter, saying that if you are not serving Bhagavan, your breathing will be like that of the, how is it say? Bellows? Like the bellows. So yeah, you're breathing, but breathing doesn't mean alive. Generally, that's the symptom. Is he alive or not? Check his breathing. But in bhakti terms, it's some other thermometer. So the more we surrender to Krishna, the more alive we become. And the more alive he becomes in our life. Now, the more he intervenes in our lives, which doesn't mean that we stop having will. Now, that's an important point also, because sometimes we say, the more I surrender to Krishna, the more he intervenes in my life. Yes. But also, the more I have real free will by doing that. Because we say free will, but how free is your will now? But if you become a perfectly aligned personality, you have real free will. So you are really yourself in the full sense. And Krishna also is intervening the full in your life. But when you are not surrendered to him, he's not intervening that much personally. And you are not intervening that much yourself personally in your own life. Because you're not paying that much attention to your own will. So Jiva Goswami says, therefore the devotees just need to remain alive. In other words, paying attention to real life, bhakti, they don't need even to sthanesthita, as this Brahma said in verse number 3. They don't need to change too much of their present situation, even if they practice bhakti. They don't need to go to a cave. They don't need to retire from, society or family life. They don't have to practice, control the breathing and develop some psychic powers. You just keep doing all the things you are doing in bhakti, because you will continue doing those same things in eternity. That's how user-friendly bhakti is. In bhakti, we are doing something that we expect to continue doing forever. That's an interesting idea. It's not that I'm doing something so I can stop doing that someday and I can really do what I like. That's what most people do in life. No, they go to work from Monday to Friday. No, they do something they don't like. So in the weekend, they can do something they think they like. But actually they don't like either. They're not that satisfied at the end. Or some people engage in karma kanda and do lots of penance so they attain swargalok. So they deprive themselves of lots of things here so they can enjoy there totally. So there is a big difference from their sadhana and their sadhya. But bhakti means I'm doing this so I can continue doing this more. Like when they ask Srila Prabhupada, what's the result of chanting Hare Krishna? And he was kind of surprised by the question and replied like in a very innocent way. And direct said, well, like the result of chanting Hare Krishna that you will be able to chant more Hare Krishna. Was there another idea? No? Well, maybe we may have another idea yet, but for him it was like, how can you think of anything else apart from this? This is the highest thing. Like we said the other day, when the Brajavasis asked Krishna, can you show us our next life? And Krishna said, yes, of course. No? And he said, close your eyes. No, he created some mysticism. Now open your eyes. And they opened their eyes, and then Krishna showed them like a vision. And in the vision, they were there doing the exactly same thing they were doing at that moment. It was like if he had put like a mirror. Your next life, this is the next, your next life. And I show you just all of you, unfortunately, having to listen to me again on the lecture. I mean, let's change the lecturer. No, and put Guru Maharaj here. And you'll say, wow, great. We'll continue hearing Harikatan, sharing and chanting together, and popcorn will come after. So, okay, next life, no problem. So that's bhakti, no? Like when Uddha was saying, Tvayopabhukta Shraganda, and so on, he's saying, that's my renunciation, is I'm wearing your garments, you're eating your remnants, and all that's a princely standard in Krishna Dwarka, but that's his renunciation. It's I only sustaining on your remnants. That's the highest renunciation. So that's the notion here. No, the bhakti is a difficult path to understand, as Guru Maharaj will say, because on one extreme you have karma, which is material exploitation. And you may think, oh, the opposite, the spirituality must be then renunciation. So when you see someone walking with a loincloth and dressing asses and just dreadlocks till the other block, like you may find in India, and some of them buy the dreadlocks, by the way. I don't know if you know that. Sometimes you see these yogis with the dreadlocks like this room. You say, wow, that must mean like 40 years of having dreadlocks. And maybe they went to Loy Bazaar and they got some like, and they attached the dreadlock and then they have it. Yeah. I mean, serious. I mean, I'm not saying everyone is like that, but you have your dreadlocks shop there, yeah. But my point is, you see that, and you may say, like, wow, that person is super advanced or super spiritual. And when you see, like, someone like, I don't know, Pundarik Vidyanidhi, or like Uddha, you may say, oh, that doesn't seem overtly spiritual. I mean, that seems pretty opulent, or like Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta riding a car at that time, where a sannyasi was supposed to only walk barefoot throughout the whole India. And they asked, why you as a sannyasi, as a Vaishnava, you are using cars? And he will reply again, like, Prabhupada, cars should be only used by Vaishnavas, he said. They know how to connect this technological development with its source. Only us should be using actually them. He made upwards the whole question. No? Why you are the only us should be doing that. The point is, bhakti is not easy to understand because it's a middle path. It's quite nuanced. No, I mean, it doesn't overtly seem renounced. It seems mundane. What to speak, Brajavasis, they seem pretty ordinary. And again, Brahma is having direct experience of this. Just 5 minutes ago, he thought, this is super ordinary. This guy's having a picnic. I mean, this is topmost goal. I show this to the world. And he was like, oh, okay. Anyhow, let's conclude with Bhishmanath Chakrabarti Thakur's commentary. He says, a devotee understands that the happiness and distress he undergoes by performing bhakti, the happiness, and by committing aparad, the distress. Now he's connecting these points. All these are special mercy from the Lord. So the happiness I receive by doing it right in bhakti, mercy of Krishna. The distress I'm receiving by committing aparad is the mercy of Krishna. Not the aparad in itself, but the result of that coming in an educational way to me. And he said, it is like the father who sometimes makes his child drink milk and sometimes makes him drink bitter neem juice. Have you tasted neem juice? Okay, imagine the most possible bitter thing you could ever taste. And more. So that's the idea. Sometimes the father embraces his and kisses his son, and sometimes he slaps him. Thus, the devotee accepts whatever happens to him as the arrangement of the Lord, acting for his benefit. So this is the idea, no? The devotee will think, again, doesn't care if it comes in a sweet packaging or bitter packaging. If it's coming from Krishna's agency, no? That's what I care for. No? I don't care the size and the color of the packaging. I care for who is sending this to me. That's coming from Krishna. And bitter, sweet, that's secondary consideration. First consideration coming from him. And if coming from him, it's affectionate. And affection can take different forms. Sometimes I will caress you, and sometimes that hurts. I even slap you. No. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada won't say that in one purpose in the Bhagavatam. Guru sometimes will embrace the disciple, sometimes will slap the disciple. Not necessarily literally, but may chastise, may just pinch. Or literally, if it's required. If there is enough love and affection. I mean, if it's coming from an affectionate source, that's showing only affection and concern. Of course, you must have done some extreme nonsense to receive that. If not, he will just slap you because he likes to slap people. No? But he will say, in both cases, embrace and slap. Slap? In both cases, Guru is giving mercy. Of course, I'm not with this justifying unnecessary violence and abuse. Please try to get the point. But the point is, mercy and affection can take different forms. No? And we shouldn't be like too attached. Krishna only caressing with me. Mm-hmm. Your mercy in this way. That's again when we are idealizing mercy. This should happen in this way. And generally we will ask the caressing packaging. But actually to say that the special form of mercy, if you want even to compare the two, is chastisement. Because that shows I'm having a special confidence with you to the point that I chastise you. I mean, you won't chastise any people. Any and every person. You have to have some intimate connection with someone to really chastise the person. And that the person may feel, oh, he really cares for me. Mm-hmm. You know, he wants. It's like if I walk running towards, how do you say?
The cliff.
Yeah. And the other person, so your well-wisher say, hey, stop. You're going to kill yourself. Oh, I didn't know, sorry, thank you. You saved my life or something. Now, the slapping was not because of repressed violence. You are just about to kill yourself. That's all. So that's Shastra saying, Tada Varsan Hai Kripada Lakshan. Chastisement is a special sign of mercy. Interesting. Again, we are not masochists, but we are to understand sometimes it's necessary. Srila Sriramas once he said that. He said, oh, Gurudev has chastised me. He followed this unique logic. He said, oh, Gurudev has chastised me. That means he considers me his property. I'm saved, he concluded. If Gurudev considers me his property, means he considers he can do whatever he likes with me, I'm saved. Because again, you won't chastise any and every person. You have to have some confidence. So Guru is chastising. I mean, he's showing me how much close he is to me. I'm saved. So that's the way to go. Not just, oh, Guru is chastising. I didn't like that. And why he's doing like that. And he doesn't love me as I will. And all this type of, like, again, superficial considerations. Mm-hmm. We should understand the background. Again, if it's coming from an affectionate side, we are not justifying unnecessary slapping here. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur concludes saying, and we conclude here as well, as the inheritance from the father maintains the life of the son, so the attainment of liberation and service to the Lord maintains the life of the devotee. No? So another point. No? Inheritance will maintain us financially, bhakti will maintain us spiritually. Thus, while living in this world, the devotee remains fixed on the path of devotion. He's been maintained by bhakti. And just the conclusion of Brahma in this verse by Srinath Chakravarti, not Vishwanath, but Srinath, who is Kavi Karnapur's guru, he says, therefore, and referring back to the verse, only bhakti brings about the highest good for the sake of which you descend for the benefit of the devotees. Brahma is saying to Krishna. This kind of summarizes previous verses. Hence, only bhakti should be done. So this verse is kind of starting a new section from next verse onwards, but also kind of summarizes many points from seen in the first seven verses. Anyhow, some thoughts. Sorry for the extension. And we have some questions or some comments. We have some minutes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
You mentioned that, if I understood you properly, that everything Krishna does, he does for a reason. Maybe you could explain that. Because if that's what you said,
mm-hmm.
because it seems like it's couldn't Krishna do something for no reason? Or...
Yeah, of course, when we say everything Krishna does is for a reason, yes, of course. We may not know the reason in the ultimate specific detail, but why specifically in this particular situation he's allowing this to happen in my life. I mean, in general terms, of course, we will say because he wants us closer to him, and he's calling us through that. It may be like a generic reply, although it's pretty specific also. But basically, at the end of the day has to do with trusting his intentions towards us. That's why we have chosen this path, and we are trying to develop a relationship with him, because we trust him as a person. Of course, he's a supreme person, but still as a person with intentions, and who's trying to approach us in a particular relationship. So, I mean, if you open yourself to a relationship with someone, anyone, God included, it's because you are trusting the approach of that person, and you are opening yourself more and more. And sometimes you may, even at some point of the relationship, there may be moments where you don't understand why the other person is doing what they are doing. But if the relationship reached a certain point, there will be unconditional trust. No? Like, I don't understand why you're doing that, but I trust you. No. Maybe, I don't know, that person is preparing some surprise birthday party, and he's moving in a strange way that day and coming. Where are you going? I'm just coming. I just said, what's going on here? No. But I love him, and that person loves me. I know I trust. And eventually, everything makes perfect sense. Now I understand. So something like that with Krishna also, no? I mean, he's preparing one party after another, if you will. But in the meantime of the process, you may think, why he did like that? Why? Why is it? Wait. I mean, he's organizing the whole party. No? Let him make the full surprise. No, don't ruin the party before. And if we have the proper patience and tolerance, eventually we'll... Now full circle. No? But sometimes we need to wait. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta will say that. No, one of the symptoms that we want to enjoy in this world is that we don't have patience in front of the arrangement that Krishna is doing in our life. He makes some arrangement, and we became impatient. No? Like we want something different from that arrangement to be happening. And we do not wait for the arrangement to blossom, if you will. So that's a test for our faith also. I mean, we need to be tested for our own welfare. So sometimes Krishna will present some apparently excruciating test that it seems to never end or something, and it's totally unexpected, and why this is going like this, and you cannot make sense. But he is able to make sense. We have to try to trust he's able to make sense, and this is conducting in some way that whenever you last expect, it makes full sense, maybe in a moment. It all makes sense in one. But he wants to see grow in our waiting, if you will. And while waiting, as we say here, we are trusting, we are increasing our surrender. Not just that we are waiting, okay, when does this will end? Some people work like this. Oh, this is not... this. Thing is, I do not like this situation, so I'm just waiting for that to finish, mm-hmm. so I continue my life. But it's, with Krishna, it's not like that. No, this is coming. This is Krishna's knocking today. It's not that I don't like that one. send a more fancy knocking, and then I will open the door. No, no. Atiti Devo Bhavam, the Shastra say. Atiti Devo Bhavam is you have to host an uninvited guest as if it's God himself. And that's the idea, because the implication is God himself comes to your life as an uninvited guest. Well, like, whenever you less expect it, you are doing something and suddenly, and like, oh, but you didn't tell me that you were coming. And in this way, adjust, change your angle of vision. So yeah, basically we may not always know why Krishna is doing what he's doing. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, that happens in the Leela so many times. Krishna does things and the gopis are like, what are you doing? Why are you saying that? But they cannot but love him, basically. No? So that's also a test of to our love. No, I mean, you need first to make sense of every single detail before saying, now I love you. Now that I was able to make sense of every single aspect of your... That's not love, actually. No? It's similar to say, okay, you show me that you are perfect and you are doing everything perfect and everything makes perfect sense, and then I love you when you are fully perfect. That's not Krishna.
Krishna is like a child. Sometimes he'll demand an explanation. Why do I have to fix my bed? But there's a higher level where he'll accept.
Of course, with this we are not promoting like shut up and do not ask any question and just accept and trust me. But in some way, in another way, the same sentence we are promoting. if I show to you that you can trust me fully, if that has happened, and at some situation say, Maharaj, I don't understand why you did that. And I may tell you, I mean, I don't want to put me as example, but whatever. I'm not that trustworthy, but I may tell you, I mean, I think you have proved that you can trust me. We have gone through many tests together. That's a fact, right? Yes. Okay, I understand you cannot understand, but you will understand eventually. At this moment, please trust. And again, if the confidence has been built to that point, we should trust. And there are moments when we have to trust without having all the minutiae in place there. And only then I will trust, because that means I do not trust basically that much. First, show me everything is in place, and only then I will. No, at some point there must be some risky, even feeling. Srila Siramash will say that. He will say, in the beginning, we will feel when Krishna is inviting us to all this stuff, we will feel too much risk and too little gain. So we may be more cautioned than anything else. Like, okay, too much risk here. I remain in my safe comfort zone. Eventually, as we progress, we will feel the more the risk, the more the gain. So the system will shift. Now, the more I take risk, the more I'm actually gaining. But if you progress even more, you will realize no risk, all gain. There was no risk, actually. Okay. So in that sense, I fully trust. I'm not like calculating. Better first show me and then I will believe you or something. Because if there is full love and trust, I mean, that's all. Of course, we cannot imitate that if we are not there. That may be dysfunctional. We need sometimes to ask. You cannot force trust me and don't ask questions. You have to ask questions to the guru. That's one of the aspects, pariprashnena. Inquire humbly from the guru. But the more you receive from the guru satisfactory answers, at some point the guru may say, no need for questions here, trust me. And I say, yes, okay, guru. Because you have replied so many times that now you can tell me, no questions today in this case, or just wait. Okay. So it's also important to develop that type of faith. Yeah. Some other question? Okay. I think we can leave here and we can do some little kirtan before prasad.
Sure.
Srila Gurudev ki jai, Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Shri Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Granthara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Brahma Stuti ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Bol.